has obviously been done in response to Grenfell. So John Sturgis and myself were involved quite soon after Grenfell in writing up a number of articles requested by different journals to respond to issues that were raised regarding the fire. Obviously this is subject to any inquiry. We used to run a fire studies course back in 2005, and actually probably this is pertinent to some of the issues that were challenging by now. That was the last time that we actually ran the course. So the industry's kind of taken its foot off the pedal with regard to its fire issues, fire studies, fire protection. We thought we had it sorted. Nobody at all expected to see the nature of fires that we saw in Grenfell. What was also interesting, that as we were asked to write the articles, I contacted a number of our industrial partners regarding cladding systems and asked them to just pass comment on what we're doing. And by and large, every company that I spoke to, with the exception of Rockhammer and Rockwool, took a back seat and said, Chris, just due to the nature of what's happened, is we've been asked to actually not comment on anything. I wasn't asking particularly about Grenfell, but I was wanting to know what we could do to move forward. I'll allow Rockpanel and Rockwool to tell you about their products, but what we've got really is a situation where what we saw in Grenfell was a result of the materials that we used, which we'll go into a bit more detail, which acted as a fuel. And Rockwool and Rockpanel will tell you about their products, but what we know from Rockpanel, the products that they've got, they're not a source of a fuel. So we've got a distinct difference in the type of systems that we're putting on walls. We're going to break the presentation down into three stages. Myself and John are just going to give you a bit of an introduction into Grenfell and some issues of fire. And then we'll be followed by Jenny Mustin from Rockpanel and Martin Ridley from Rockwool, who'll give you the main contents of the CPD. If you've come along late into the presentation and you've not given them your contact details, please do so after, so they can issue you with a CPD certificate. Just before I do go on to the presentation, we do have fire tests on a Wednesday. I have no idea whether one's scheduled during this week. Is it not scheduled? We don't know. So if we do hear a fire alarm, we'll just give it a few rings, and then we'll actually, if it persists, we will vacate the building. And there's fire exits going straight out of the building, straight down the stairs, and there's one at the end of the corridor. So we've got at least three routes out of this room. So we're not in a building that I expect to be called into question the subject of this presentation. So what we should first understand from Grenfell was that it was a refurbishment project. And that is quite different to the new builds. So whilst we've seen a reaction and buildings being stripped of their cladding materials, there is a significant difference between the refurbishment projects and new build projects. Quite clearly, whilst the cladding material was responsible for certainly providing the fuel, with the fuel source to the external part of the fire, there were other issues with Grenfell that are obvious, so issues that have affected the building's integrity over a long period of time. So there's lots of compromise on the internal aspects of the building that have changed the compartmentations and affected fire barriers. So we should actually certainly be mindful that there's a distinction between the two buildings. The ACM, the aluminium composite material cladding, typically with a core of polyurethane or polyethylene, are a fuel source. And so they are at risk, if that panel is compromised, they're at risk of being a flammable material. What we do know, obviously, and what's come to our mind, is that the English regulations, certainly the building regulations in England and Wales, are somewhat different now to what we've got in Scotland. So Scotland for a long time has changed its stance on what you can use on an external cladding. We're not in kilts with a lot of areas in Europe, and certainly Germany over 22 metres high, you can't use ACM. And in the States, you've got to have some form of retardant if you're going to go over 15 metres high. So we know that we're going to see a change in terms of the regulations that we've got as a result of Grenfell. So one of the things that I wanted us to do is just become aware of what exactly is needed for combustion. So we even though I'm teaching the sub-eggs, I asked John Sturgis, who was teaching fire studies for many years here, to also just give us a bit of a backdrop into the fire, how it originated, and then what was the impact potentially in Grenfell.
Right, well, it's very simple. To get a fire, you need three things. You need a fuel, something that's exothermic, in other words, burns with output of heat. Endothermic materials won't do it. You need a supply of air because oxygen supports combustion. And you need an initial source of heat to ignite the burnable material. Next one. Yeah. Now, when I first got involved with this stuff about 30 years ago, I looked at sort of fire testing methods, and the first things I came across were the old British standard methods, where you took a small sample of each material that you were interested in, and you could test it for a number of things, whether or not the material is combustible, whether it will burn or not, how much heat it produces per unit weight of material, the speed of surface spread of flame, what chemical species or fumes or toxic things are produced during combustion. Now, that's testing very small samples of material, and in real situations, materials don't occur as discrete lumps of small individual materials. They occur as composites. It might be a computer or a photocopier or a washing machine or whatever it is. So fire testing then developed along other lines, typified, I suppose, by the single burning item test, where you have an enclosure with a hood. You put a material, something in there, like a computer console or whatever it is, and you torch it, and you observe what happens. You measure the heat output with thermocouples. All the products of combustion are steered off through a hood where you can analyse them in terms of the particles, particle sizes, species, things that are toxic or whatever. You can analyse the gas produced. And this sort of technique has been used for everything from small items to big items of furniture to automobiles, because, again, over the last 40 years, if you burn a car, the heat output these days is at least twice as much as it was back in the 1960s with the all-steel motor cars. So, testing, transferring test results to a real situation is not at all straightforward. Next one, Chris. Right, the Navier-Stokes equation. Well, don't worry about the... there's lots of curly D's and partial differentials and a lot of fluke D's, but don't worry about that. If you get a fluid moving across a solid surface, you tend to get what's called a boundary layer. Molecules of the fluid actually stick to the surface of the solid. They stand there. The next layer of particles are dragged by these and attracted by them, so they only move across slowly. The layer after that go a bit quicker and a bit quicker and so on. So you get this what's called a boundary layer. Now, the steepness of that velocity gradient depends on the viscosity of the fluid, and that's where the Navier-Stokes equation comes in, as a viscosity term. Now, this principle was very graphically illustrated in the King's Cross fire. That was investigated. It was one of the very first fire investigations to use computational fluid dynamics. and they simulated the escalator at the angle with the side walls to it, and of course they expected that the fire plume would do as it normally does and rise up to the ceiling. Well, when they ran the computer model, they found that that wasn't what the computer showed. It showed that the plume ran right up the stairway between the side walls to the top into the ticket hall, and it only went vertical when it emerged at the top of the escalator, and they were amazed. So they had to run a test to see whether that was what really happened in real life. They built a model of this trench at the, I think it was the Safety in Mind research place in Derbyshire. They lit a little fire partway up and then videoed what happened, and sure enough the plume went up the trench and only went vertical once it emerged. And again, once you see that, you think, ah, yes, boundary layer. It's this attractive force that holds the moving fluid to the solid surfaces and keeps the whole thing contained within the trench. And it's now been called the trench effect, and that was an occasion when all the fire engineers around the world learned something new. Now, in the case of the Grenfell Tower, as Chris has said, there was obviously some combustible material in the cladding, because if you compare what the Grenfell Tower looked like with what the Twin Towers looked like on 9/11, if you remember the pictures there, the flame and smoke and stuff that issued had quite a big horizontal trajectory, and the stuff came out and moved up, so that the fire looked a bit like the branches on a tree going upwards. Grenfell, the flames were slapped close to the wall all the way up because of this boundary layer effect. And the thing that obviously made it different from the Twin Towers was the external surface of the Twin Towers was not combustible. So no heat was generated at that point, so the gases could just shoot out of the window. There was no attractive force to get them to stick to the wall, whereas in Grenfell that wasn't the case. As soon as the stuff started to burn, then it kept the moving hot gas close to the wall, which of course rapidly ignited the layer above. So vertical spread of flame was very, very fast. The thing that I've not got the details of the construction, but one of the things I used to emphasise when I taught this stuff was the importance of fire stopping. Smoke and flame and things and heat can find ways through a building unless you completely insulate the various compartments. Now, when this cladding, if it was applied and there were spaces through which heat and flame could penetrate the layer, because there was a layer of cladding and then there was an air gap, I think, and then the panel on the outside, then the heat can get in, and since it's exothermic, it will burn. So attention to fire cladding is very important. And the other thing to note before I sit down and shut up is that these insulation panels, to do their job, have to have a very low thermal diffusivity. That is, heat diffuses through them very slowly. If they burn, they'll burn, but the flame front will advance very slowly into the block of material, and so they will burn for a rather extended period of time. Okay, I think that's about all I want to say. Chris, if you want to kick off with the details.
So really just sort of reiterating some of the points that John's made there. This is some of the information that I managed to take off the web in terms of details, which I was asked to, when we were writing the article, I was asked to review. And what I actually quickly noted was that people were commenting on the details, on things that just weren't true. So we can see the standard makeup, and these are supposedly how we're supposed to be constructed. And people were making comments about the fact that the fire could jump out of this window detail, saying that there was nothing between the window frame and the external cladding. But actually, we know that that's not constructed like that, because we know that, that windowsills don't just sit there and levitate on their own. So, but this is typical of the details that we do see on construction sites, which somebody's left with a bit of the construction that you've got to fill in. And somebody is going to get held culpable as a result of Grenfell. We know that. I don't know it, but we can see that someone's going to be responsible. And unfortunately, these are some of the things that, that we've got. But we've got the ACM cladding, and we've got an air gap, and we've got the insulation, which is a fuel source behind it, which we can now see on all buildings in the UK. This has been stripped off the face of them. We also know that the fire barriers have got to actually be effective, have got to be 100% complete. And these are, again, some construction details that, that were taken of Grenfell. And we can see that there's gaps in the fire stops. And we also don't know, we can't see on the images whether there were any vertical fire stops. That being said, when I first looked at these images, if I was asked to inspect them prior to seeing Grenfell, it wouldn't have rang particular alarm bells. So what I look at is what looks like a relatively good cladding system that's been applied to a building. It's been used across the country elsewhere before. I'm told that it's sufficient. So I can see why we're actually got ourselves into this situation where we're not 100% sure which test that we should be using from the building regulations. We're not really sure what applies, but we can see that in other areas of the UK and still, I think, in Scotland, they have been used. We're not going to make that mistake again, but we also probably should be better at inspecting our buildings to ensure that we have got continuous horizontal and vertical barriers to make sure we don't get fire spread. The thing that I also was surprised at, and what John said to me, and even though what our group does is study thermal performance of buildings, is obviously insulation's got a low thermal diffusivity, as he said. So when it ignites, as long as the flame is touching it, then it burns, but it actually burns for a long time. It acts as a fuel source for a long period of time, and we can see that that's not acceptable. What is also surprising, when I started to look at the building regulations, is that the whole base of the building regulations came around from the Fire of London, so the reason we have them and the reason we lead the world in regulations is because we saw that there was first and foremost a need to control the spread of fire. However, I spent the best part of 2 weeks looking at all of the components of the regulations, trying to fit them together and determine what the minimum requirements were. And I came to a position. One is, for almost any professional on site, it was actually quite busy. It was virtually impossible for everybody to actually pull the documents together. Certainly, when I was looking at the British standards and the European standards that applied, they're about £200 a piece. And when you actually look at the back pages of approved documents, you've got at least 20 of those that are a list 20 or more that are listed. So for some of you may have access to it, and then there's certainly a time issue. It took me a long time to find relevant parts of British standards and European standards. And in the end, what I actually arrived at was there's probably one line in the building regulations that's going to be reused during the next few months to actually say what standard we should be working to. And that is, the external envelope of a building should not provide a medium for the spread of fire. It is likely to be a risk to health and safety. I've seen arguments on the web about that. It then goes on to mention combustible materials, therefore we are considering combustible materials. But there's an overarching emphasis in the regulations to ensure that health and safety of the occupants through the facade is not compromised through fire. If I was asked to act as an expert witness on either side under the regulations, I think I could do a reasonable job. Yeah, so that's saying that at the moment we've got an argument that is actually pretty wide. But this is a standard. We shouldn't be building buildings with combustible materials. We can see that under the building regulations there's reference to, under Class O, to non-combustible materials, which is a building regulations definition. And then we can also see, or to the international standard BS3B2. And it took me a while to find the required document for this, and actually what it was referring to. So under Class B, and if you search on the web, you will see people discussing limited sustainability, limited combustion or non-combustion. And actually, the document actually doesn't refer to anything like that at all. It refers to a test. And it basically says under the surface flame attack and where edge flame attack is provided with 30 seconds exposure, there shall be no flame spread in excess of 150 millimetres vertically from the point of application to the test within 60 seconds from the time of application and within 50 seconds from the time of application. So it's not to refer, it's referring to a spread of flame under that test regime. There's also the subclasses S3, which is which allows unlimited smoke propagation, and I think Jenny and Martin will discuss this further. And then D2, which is fire droplets, and that basically allows virtually as much smoke as can be produced from these this material, and to drop as much droplets of fire from the material. And the only thing that we've got limiting it is that particular test. So you've got two extremes in the regulations when they're referring to tests. One which gives you class O, which is a limited combustibility, and the other one is this end, which is clearly what's caused some of the problems. And people think they can pick any cladding system and put it on the face of the building. And clearly, if we look at what the regulations are trying to do, they're trying to protect the health and safety of the occupants, so we can't do that unless you're going to actually put a full-scale test together and have it run by the BRE or equivalent testing facility. I'll skip on for that. The case that we used to use and John used to use was the Dublin Stardust nightclub, and I showed you the experiment that the BRE set up. The reason I think that was important, there's a number of videos that actually copy that video that was produced. I don't think it's available officially by the BRE, which is a shame now. I think you still have to buy it. So there are YouTubes on there. But what it does show is the BRE actually got it wrong when they set up that experiment. So they built an enclosure with an open wall, which clearly didn't represent what was happening in the Stardust nightclub. They put the materials in there and they allowed, I think it was a cigarette end, to smoulder a bit on a chair. But what was important was actually once the fire got hold, the flashover shocked the researchers so much that they were stumbling over their equipment to get out of an open-ended building. If we see a fire smouldering on a cigarette end, we should put it out. It's not a problem. Normally when we have a problem with a fire, it's taken a hold. And if you walk into a room and you see a fire that's got some sort of hold, you don't know what point that is from flashover. And it's not how many minutes it's going to take, is how many seconds. So John pointed it out that he once used to show images from a slide and two images and say how long did it get from this stage to this stage, and you said it was a few seconds.
Yeah, just one other thing, going back to the testing of materials in that Stardust nightclub, the surface covering to the upholstery was non-flammable, and they showed you a bloke dropping a fag end onto it and it would not ignite. However, what they ignored was the fact that if that covering split or somebody slashed it, the underlying upholstery was flammable, and that's how it started. So, you know, this is why applying fire tests can be problematic.
Yeah, and I think you can see why the BRE have gone to the full 3-4 storey fire testing regime now. Other fires that did pretty much the same as Grenfell, but probably not quite as much fuel up the surface, were Langnell. And fires which are of also interest to us, there's a number of fires that have been happening in Dubai where ACM is well used. The interesting thing is nobody's getting killed in Dubai. They're new buildings, and quite clearly the passive protection measures that they've got in place within the building have not been compromised like they were on the retrofit. So the Grenfell is an old building. Notwithstanding that, I still don't think this is acceptable to see fires on multi-storey buildings going up the face of the building. The fact that nobody's been killed in them is luck. Because obviously if there's a child or somebody who can't get out the front of that building, then you're not going to escape that. There are a lot of unanswered questions on this, but hopefully the presentations by Jenny and Martin will help see what's available from the rock panel and how the regulations apply to buildings over 18 storeys. I think we've got a number of people from Rock Panel and Rockwall to ask questions. So Dale Crampton, where's Dale? Dale, Anne from Rock Panel, Jenny Mustard, and Martin Ridley, who are going to present. But if there's any questions after their presentations, we can raise those. I'll hand you straight over, because I don't want to take up more time. But hopefully that's given you some thought, some things to think about as you try to look into what's happening with fire and where we should be going. The overarching statement is you shouldn't be building with combustible materials, and I think the regulations do state that. And certainly if I was asked to argue, that's where my position lies, and unless you can totally seal those materials up, which I don't think you can properly do. Thank you.